My name is Bob Baker. This is the second session in a series of three. The series is entitled Self-Identity and Relationships. In today's particular session, I've entitled it Reading Unwritten Rules in the Family. Now, maybe there was something about that title that frightened a few people off. I don't know. This is a continuation, really, of last evening's discussion. It will be the same kind of material. And yesterday and today, the general slant might be called setting forth some of the problems encountered in family relationships and self-identity. And then if we spend 2 days setting up the problem, like tomorrow, we're supposed to solve it. So you see, the series of three will give us the whole truth, you know, everything. And then you can go away and it will be happy forever after. For those of you who may not have been here last evening, we talked about looking at a person and whether we should study an individual as an isolated individual, which I'm suggesting is the classical Freudian approach, with the psychiatrist sitting above the person's head out of view and supposedly not contaminating the process. Whether we look at an individual that way or to see them, as I'm suggesting, as one of many elements on a mobile. That is, the individual person is to be understood in their environment, specifically the environment which is the context of the family. The constellation of significant people in their lives, which for most of us is parents and siblings. So obviously I'm taking the latter approach, and that's being suggested by a lot of studies, whether the field is international politics or economics or physics, biology, or theology. Scripture is being informed and studied now. Texts are looked at in their context, and not just their biblical context on the page, but the context in which those pages were initially composed. So systems approach is certainly, I think, informing a lot of material these days. And I think it provides some helpful and exciting tools for understanding ourselves and the relationships that we find ourselves in. Again, in the library on the reference shelf, you should find a copy of Virginia Satir, People Making, which deals a lot with relationships and roles. Last evening we talked about roles and some about rituals. Family Crucible is a narrative type book that you can read and kind of look in on the process of a family working with two therapists and see how the presenting problem of the one youngster is just like the tip of the iceberg and really gets the whole family involved in this, in the process. So the technical jargon we're talking about, if you want some of the lingo, it's family systems. And what I put on the board here and last night is called genograms. It's graphing the genealogy of the family system. Now, before I get launched in, were there any unfinished questions or unfinished business from yesterday that somebody wants to, you went home and you thought about it and I said, now wait a minute, that sounded good last night, but having given it some thought, anybody have a...
It sounded even better after I got home.
Oh, okay. Well, I heard various responses. It ranged anywhere from, I got something out of that session that told me about myself and some of the relationships I'm in, and it was helpful. Anywhere from there to somebody saying, well, I heard him for an hour and I didn't hear anything new. So that's how it is. Well, all right. Anything you want to share in particular about? Okay. We talked some about roles. What are the various roles of the spouses, the parents, husband, wife, oldest sibling, middle sibling, younger ones, and... I find this a little difficult in this kind of a setting because it has to be all in general terms. Where I most frequently encounter this is meeting with a couple. I worked for a little over couple of years or so in a large Lutheran congregation as director of counseling ministries. And all of the couples who got married there, part of the requirement was they had to spend 10 to 14 hours with me, individually, not as a group. So we dealt with the particulars of their relationship and their families and who they are. It is kind of what we did. And some of them came in with a chip on their shoulder because it was a requirement. And but by the time we got going, we were having fun, and they just kind of got into the process.
I think in that, you know, in our situation, when we were talking yesterday about how did the role change after 20, 25 years down the line.
Right.
And maybe the children leave. I think the oldest one, who marries the youngest one, takes hold and kind of is the bossy one. That's me. And after a while, you think, well, this is not right. I really wish he would make the decisions. And boy, to change at that point is nearly impossible. So it becomes a real point of contention. You don't know how to all of a sudden say, when you've been getting it your way and they do what you say, and then all of a sudden you think, well, I don't really want this role anymore.
Yes.
You just can't toss it out.
Yeah, right.
It's frustrating.
I'm glad you said that, because that I really didn't illustrate well, this business of a mobile. Yesterday, I didn't think. What I wanted to say about the family and why the comparison of a mobile, not just because we've got all these lines with circles on them, if a mobile is hanging there, it establishes equilibrium. Somewhere it gets a balance. Now, a little breeze might come through and it might shift. But there's a basic equilibrium. And if you move one item further out on a stick or closer into the center, the whole thing shifts. Now, that happens in families. When somebody changes, the whole family is affected. But where families are more dynamic than a mobile, is that the tendency in a family is to restore the initial equilibrium. So maybe the most frequent example is the alcoholic who goes to a treatment center and gets dried out and returns to the family setting. What happens? Well, frequently, if the family is not in on the process of change, that individual's change, there's a disequilibrium in the family, and the family members will conduct themselves in such a way as to restore the previous equilibrium that was familiar and hence comfortable. They were at home in that environment, and so the individual becomes an alcoholic again. You know, that pattern was so prominent that it was obvious. And so treatment centers, just like I'm saying in counseling in general, have gone from trying to treat the individual to dealing with the family. Families are required in I'd say most contemporary centers to be involved in the process one way or another. Yeah. Because they have to change and buy into the new mobile, the new arrangement.
That happened in my family. My brother is an alcoholic, and he went to detox about three times and came back home, and within any period of time, once it was 2 years, but he went right back to drinking.
Yeah.
Until the family confronted him, and then the whole family got involved, and now he hasn't had a drink
yeah.
in 14 years, and he's doing great.
The point where this was really driven home to me, I was a hospital chaplain, but I was also working in the psychiatric unit. And in that unit, I was in on the intake interview with people. And so there was one person in particular had attempted suicide and was admitted to the psychiatric unit, and the family was there. And so the nurse had just collected medical information and did that intake interview. And then I went in and visited with the whole family. And this fellow's wife was there and their three children, and to listen to them talk to each other I mean, if I were that fellow, I would have, you know, made the exit as soon as I could have, too. That was the most convoluted system of double-bind messages. It didn't matter what was said, you were wrong, see? It, you know, you couldn't win in that situation. That was incredible. Well, the treatment prescribed for the fellow who attempted suicide was shock treatment. You know, they hooked the wires up to the head and go zappo, which I thought was in the Middle Ages. And that blew my mind, and I didn't have any wires hooked up. Well, I went and talked to the psychiatrist who was in charge of that case. You know, and I still say the psychiatric model focus is the individual. And I said, for crying out loud, you know, this doesn't make any sense to me. I really don't understand why you're doing this. And furthermore, I'm really bothered by it. Because meeting with the family, I can see that you scramble this fellow's brain, you know, enough that he's got to be fed, and that sort of, you know, levels it out, and then send him back home, and it's going to be back in the same environment where the suicide was precipitated. And try it again. And the response was, so I said, you know, what really is the purpose, and why not have the family in here? And the response was, well, for the psychiatrist, the purpose of this was to keep this fellow out of the obituary column. He said, I don't have access to the family, and so I can't do anything about it, so all I'm going to do is just try to keep him out of the obituary column, and if he's back in here in 3 or 4 months, you know, we'll do it again. In 3 or 4 months after that, we'll do it again. And I, you know, how futile, how utterly futile. But it underscores how powerful the family is. Okay, so what we may talk about today are a little bit more about some rituals, but I want to pursue rules. Now, these aren't written rules, they aren't legislative rules.
Getting back to sure. That, treating the individual versus the whole family, isn't there a big trend away from just treating the individual alone and towards treating the whole family as a unit and other, you know, important people in the individual's life too?
Right. That's what I'm suggesting. We're moving from the Freudian model to the current model is more inclusive, involves more people. And some, you know, and there isn't any classical or orthodox methodology here. It's being developed. I mean, this is what's new in the field of psychology, one of the new areas. But it's new in biblical studies, it's new in international politics and economics, you know, to really look at how all the parts impact the other parts. So it's not a settled agenda. Some of the experimentation or some of the process involves bringing in marriage counseling, you know, the spouse. Others attempt to bring in the both adults and all the children. Other practitioners attempt to bring in the two adults, their children, and the two adults' parents and siblings. And, you know, I've heard of gatherings where they get 120 people together. Well, I mean, those are all-day events, and some of it is kind of stage. Well, I don't know, but it's interesting what the results are. You know, and others involved could be employers or employees or colleagues of whatever sort. So, that's an exciting venture, I think. Yes.
Did you mention Maggie Scarfe's book, Intimate Partners?
No, I didn't.
Are you familiar
with it? If I were to give a bibliography, I think we could spend a whole hour. Just, the literature is enormous.
Have you read it? Have you seen the book?
Yes.
Because I think it's an exceptional one of putting it all together.
Yes.
And making it very readable.
Yeah. I don't think we have that one in the bookstore. The one that I plug for readability and brevity as a general introduction is Family Ties That Bind. I found that to be helpful in... So suggest, and that's in the reference section of the library today, this weekend. Okay, back to the family here. One way of getting at what you might call rules, I sort of want to back off from that because they're not really announced rules. And that's what makes them powerful. They're not negotiated. They're unwritten. They're implied. They're certainly understood by everybody. And I want to suggest they are in charge rather than the participants when that's the case. I mean, I know of one family of seven children who, you know what it's like these days with even just husband and wife. And maybe one or two children. But if you think about seven children and at mealtime for supper, they're going in this direction. You know, there's McDonald's and there's pizza and there's this person's schedule and that person's activity. And can you, how do you get all nine of them around the same table at the same time for a meal? And nowadays, it seems it just doesn't happen. In this family, Sundays at 4 o'clock, everybody is always there. Nobody talks about it. It's just understood. And nobody violates the rule. Well, those kind of rules crop up in all aspects of our lives together, in all aspects of our relationships. And it's the unarticulated rules that are most powerful. Because they're not out front. They're not on the table for us to discuss and negotiate and change. Now, that's kind of giving a clue to what I want to talk about more tomorrow in terms of, well, what do we do about this so that we're not just carbon copies of the pathology of the family that we grew up in or some kind of a knee-jerk rebel. So I have a list here. Is that, I don't know, can you read from that distance? Mm-hmm. Can you see?
Your eyes are better than mine.
Okay, well, I have up here marriage, children, discipline, religion, money, work, alcohol, drugs, feelings, conflict, affection, violence, sexuality, recreation, hobbies, parents, relatives. The word conflict is not there. And there may be other words. And, you know, if you think there's something missing, why, tell me. I'll write it on here.
It is there.
Pardon?
It is there. It's next to feelings.
Did I read it? Oh, it's over here on its own column. Thank you. Good. What I do with this list, now when I have 10 to 14 hours with a couple, is to talk about, well, how does it function or influence this family over here, whichever topic we're on? How is it practiced? How is it utilized? And just kind of look at the family through that lens and talk about how it functions, which gives us clues about the rules, written or otherwise, in that family. Then move over here and say, well, how does that apply over here? And how do you experience it? Who does what? And so on and so forth. And then talk about, well, now here's Kate, the oldest of four, who's engaged to Will, the youngest of three. And you'll notice that Will is the youngest of three, actually. Ann and John got married after Ann and Frank were divorced. Ann and Frank had one child, Sarah, who currently is living with somebody. Now these are long, you develop your own notation in a way, but it's a way of mapping it out, which is a way of visualizing. Now if your orientation is auditory, this may not help. Admittedly, mine is more visual than auditory. And so I find pictures and diagrams like this very helpful for getting a feel or an introduction to people. What I'd like to do now is have you select things off of here, and we'll talk about it, and we'll just develop some hypothetical situations. And it will have a little bit to do with you and your experience, and it will have a little bit to do with me and my experience, and then we'll... Yes.
Are you looking for volunteers?
You bet. Well,
discipline.
What? Which one?
Discipline.
Discipline. Okay. I wonder why you selected that one.
I just kind of came to you.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Let's deal with this family. Well, which side would you like to work with first? Doesn't matter. Okay. What are different approaches to discipline?
natural consequences.
Okay, natural consequences. Is that, for you, is that what some people call logical consequences? Yeah, natural or logical consequences. What's another one?
Physical punishment.
Physical punishment. Okay. What are some other options?
Strict versus lenient.
Okay, we could have strict, lenient meaning anything goes.
No, pretty much.
Yeah, you're on your own. Anything goes. And now lenient could also mean, well, we've got some parameters. But we have a little grace in there, but there's still some rules. And this one over here really highlights it. This is the opposite. Okay, well let's see.
But mental or psychological punishment.
Okay, there's physical punishment. There would be mental punishment. I'm trying to think of a particular example. See, when people come for premarital counseling, we don't usually deal with discipline. They don't have kids yet, most of them.
I think that should be dealt with. It seems like it becomes very important.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah,
sometimes
that's
can
right.
really be one of the main things.
Well, that's right. Okay, well, you can help me out with a story here. But the idea is, let's set up opposites. This system over here is, you're on your own. We'll put the chaos over on this side. It just kind of, everybody fends for themselves and does what they want to do. How is it at the end of the book of Judges, the last verse, what is it, Judges? There was no king in the land, and everybody did what they wanted to do. Now, this family over here, which looks like it's a little bit more traditional, we'll say this is the strict system. So here comes Kate out of a family where the rules are you toe the line. Pardon?
Rigid.
And Kate is the oldest of the youngsters here. And so she is seeped in that tradition and one of its enforcers as far as keeping the younger three in line. And she gets married to Will, who comes from a lax system of discipline and is the youngest, so he's even babied and pampered, and you know, who expects Will to do anything? Well, say they get married, and then they have they themselves have some children. What happens when this one here steps out of line?
The other one lets them know.
Who lets them know?
It depends on which parent is working with them.
Kate lets them know.
Okay, Kate is going to remind, we'll give this Benji here, or Ben, give him a name. Actually, I should have been drawing this different. Guys are squares. I know, the gals think that's humorous. Guys are squares. I wondered why it didn't look right. Kate will get in, will correct Ben. Then what happens?
Will said,
and Will comes over here and says, "Oh, just leave him alone. Just, you know, it's no big deal.
Okay.
Back off." And then what do we have? But tension in this relationship. Now, do you want to You want to set the case up? You want to add something to that situation?
Sure,
good.
Let's take going. Let's take going to sleep. A child wakes up in the middle of the night.
Okay.
And it's obvious that the intended result, both parents and everybody in the whole dormitory agree.
It sounds like this could have been last night.
That he really should go back to sleep. He should quit crying. Okay. And there would seem to be some options, not a lot. One way of keeping the child quiet is to take the child in bed with the parents. And if the child is sick or in unusual situations, that may be appropriate. But as a typical way of dealing with that problem, this would, at least I would assume, would not be an appropriate behavior because it's very hard to correct once it's been started. So that's one option. Another option would be to let the child cry until the child falls asleep, which when you're all staying in the same room and there are people within 10 feet of you who have no ownership of that child, that's probably not as good an option. As I look at your list, there could be an attempt to intercede and create some consequences, as in discipline, I suppose spanking or some form of discipline. Another would be removal of the child from the situation, i.e. taking him outside, finding a place where the child could cry until they get done crying. But that would be a situation. Are you interested in the parents? Reaction to that, or are you more interested in the problem?
Have you discovered the reading room down here in the center?
What I'm interested in is showing how the family rules, the way of operating in this system and in this one is different, and exploring, well, how has it worked out in this relationship?
Okay.
You know, how does Kate, how does this family develop, or how is that reflected in Kate's self-understanding and the rules that she brings with her? Now, you know, I put rules in quote marks because it's not like she sat down and thought about it. And the same for Will, and what happens in here. So this is a little bit more general. See, when you talked about this particular situation last night, you know, that really particularizes. But the interesting thing is that you referred to the environment. You know, the situation is not somehow isolated at home. You know, other people are involved. So you might say, well, there's only three possibilities. Either in a situation like that, either I change myself and my own attitude, somehow I influence change in the other person, or we change the environment. So maybe taking the child to the reading room is changing the environment. You're out of the dormitory and all the other people who aren't sleeping because of the noise. Or you expect that you yourself will just go back to sleep and ignore the noise, or you can feed the child or cuddle the child or bring them to bed with you and hence influence them to be quiet, or some combination thereof. But it's when you come up here, you know, when you're with other people, things you might do at home are inappropriate because the context is different. The context is an important consideration. That's what I'm trying to, among other things, underscore.
Good, but because the rule is a usually kind of thing. Usually you won't bring the kid into bed with you, but sometimes you do.
Yeah.
You know, that's a,
yeah.
There are some families, their unwritten rule is that there are no exceptions. You don't make exceptions or bend your rules.
Right.
For, you know, unusual circumstances.
And no.
Some families that are that rigid.
Yeah, yeah.
If you don't take your child into bed, you'd never do it, no matter what. Because who knows what might be there.
Yeah, who knows? Who knows? If you do it once, they'll expect you to do it again, and yes, that sort of thing, right? So
and your family had that on television the other day.
Pardon?
They had that on television the other day.
What did they
what
have?
What to do?
What to do? Did they solve it?
First, the mother or the father goes in and when the child cries, and they pacify it. You know, just stay there.
Yes.
But they don't pick it up, and they don't take it out of the bed or anything. And they finally go back to sleep. And then if it happens again, they take turns. The father and the mother take turns of doing this night after night until finally
the child. 16 years old.
Yeah.
They want the child to be self-reliant.
But that's not when you get the environment in a place like this.
Did you see
what
it
the
too
problem
on television?
Yeah. And that might work at home, but where you're here, that child is still going to keep crying until.
But we aren't really wanting to find a solution as to how to deal with the problem. We want to understand
the dynamics
how
here.
People
agree.
Put together your history to create what happens in those situations. Now, I think it's such a common thing. I mean, almost everybody faces that with their first or second child, and the conflict and the hatred because you're right and your spouse.
So you're looking at family systems.
Right.
You want to know more about a family system.
Right. What I would rather do, or what I'd like to do, is to keep the focus on the adults.
Okay.
And shy away from the children, because I remember this one Indian squaw who told an Indian chief that he was not the strongest one in the village. And he said, "But I am." "No, you're not." "But I am. I'll prove you're not." And she handed him a crying baby and said, "Make the baby stop crying." And it didn't work. And I think that's kind of a perpetual problem. What to do with youngsters who cry? But what we're looking at here are adults and their self-identity, how they understand themselves. And so that means some cognitive awareness that is not part of the children's equipment. And then looking at how that influences expectations about myself and expectations about the other person in our relationships. And so Kate is expecting that Will helps out in correcting and keeping Ben in line, and because that's how it is. Now, this is a bit of an extreme, okay, but for purposes of illustration, Kate doesn't think about the air she breathes. And in the same sense, she doesn't think about the rules of how this family operated. It's just how it is. It's a given. And all of us grow up in a family whose system or mobile hangs the way it hangs. And although we wouldn't say it this way, our attitude tends to be, "Well, isn't it that way with every family?" And listen to little kids sometimes, who maybe they grow up in an abusive situation, or maybe they grow up in a family that's forever traveling or whatever, and their attitude is, or their expectation is, well, that's the way it is in everybody's family, isn't it? Now, again, if we're really pressed with that question, if we actually think about it, we'd say, "Oh, well, no, it isn't." Cognitively, we would recognize differences, but viscerally, like the air we breathe, it's just the expectation is there. So Kate really thinks discipline is handled thus and so, and Will's different experience is different. Now they're going to get, we gave them some children already, but we were saying they're going to get married. They're talking about getting married. What does the difference in discipline, you know, how are they going to handle that? Well, the suggestion is you handle it out front. You talk about it. This is a beginning way of doing it. This doesn't preclude potholes in the road of life or flat tires on the way. I mean, there will be difficulties between Kate and Will. But seeing it coming, having something of a road map, means they're not going to get derailed. en route as easily.
Doesn't it happen often, though, that one of the families never even talks about anything? So just even the fact of putting two people together where one family talks and the other family never deals with any...
Let's use the illustration of affection, for example. And to save a little time, I won't write it up here, but there are different ways of showing affection. It can be touch. It could be by giving a card or a gift, a handmade, homemade, personally made gift. It could be by something that's spoken. I like you. I care about you. You look nice today. I love you. You know, there are different ways of expressing affection or caring, whatever word you'd want to use. So let's say over in this family, it was very verbal, and people were frequently saying, I love you. And I mean, you know, so that it was just, it was like an echo, a perpetual echo in the household. Somebody's always saying it. But over on this side, people were just kind of out on their own. It's a little more carefree and laid back, and they're not very verbal about it. But they do care about each other in their way, and the way that it's expressed is they do things for each other. Now, I'll tell you about a Will and a Kate that I met who were married, and then they got divorced, and then they got married to each other again. And then when I encountered them, they were on the verge of divorce. And among the things that were said, Kate's complaint that Will never says, I love you. He doesn't care about me. Well, how do you know he doesn't care about you? Well, he doesn't say so. He doesn't say, I love you. And, well, what had happened just the week before was that Will had just finished rebuilding the entire kitchen and all the kitchen cabinets. And Will was very good with tools and wood. And it was a beautiful job. Now, did Will care about Kate? Did he have some feelings of affection? Of course. With every tap of the hammer, Will was saying, I love you. But she didn't hear it because she didn't speak his language. And he didn't speak her language. But so the tragedy is they really cared about each other. But this family's way of expressing and receiving affection, it was so different from this one over here that it was hard for affection to really be shared, be expressed and received in that relationship. And it was very powerful just to map it out and talk about it and look at it. Now, it doesn't change things like that, because that family mobile is really much more rigid than the one that was flitting around in the breeze in the other room a couple days ago. The family system, the inertia, the dynamics are deeply ingrained. And so change is not easy. But the beginning of it was the recognition and attempts at using the other person's language. Well, there was a whole lot more to their relationship than just that. But that's, you know, so, somebody have a hand?
Maybe he was a Norwegian. Did you hear that one? This Norwegian loved his wife so much that he almost told her once.
Yeah, right. Well, that's right. It's there is a cultural factor here. You know, an affection is influenced by culture. So when I work with people, one thing I do is to go backwards on this chart and find out, well, where did you come from? Where did your parents come from? What nationality do they identify with? And oh, there's so many angles on this thing. But, you know, what's the comfortable distance for Americans? Isn't it about one arm length?
It's farther.
Well, of course, Norwegians, it's maybe two. But what is it for Italians? Isn't it more like this? You know, now can you imagine an Italian and a Norwegian, you know? Or one person coming from Northern Europe and one coming from Southern Europe. And the distance, it's there. And if you want to see the equilibrium of the mobile in operation, then go up to a Norwegian and start talking to them about like... Now, I did brush my teeth, so I don't think it's bad breath. I think it's, you know, cultural kind of thing. That's good. Okay, let's keep my eye on the clock here. Let me illustrate it with a real neutral one here for a minute. Maybe it's neutral. How about hobbies? In one family, now not all of these things are prominent in every family, but in one family it may be that the hobby is expected to pay for itself. You know, somehow you recoup your expenses by selling something or trading. In another family, hobbies get linked up a little bit with recreation, and it's a write-off, $50 a month, $100 a month. I mean, it's gone, and that's okay. I mean, that's accepted. That's the attitude about it. It's the value that's attached to the activity. So these two people from different systems get married, and then what? You know, she looks at the checkbook. You spent $70 on what? And somebody said model trains. Yeah. Well, $70, it hardly buys a transformer. Yeah, it goes quickly. So family systems, the ways of looking at rules. Unless there's one over there you want to really get at, I want to come back to rituals, which was not done fully last night by any means, just to introduce other items that come up. Rituals can be things that pertain to the day, how you get up in the morning, or when you eat, or how you go to bed at night, just the patternings of the day, or what happens when somebody comes home from work. Or weekly rituals may involve grocery shopping or laundry or whatever has a weekly routine to it. What do you do on Sunday afternoons? What do you do with Friday evenings or Saturday evenings? Or they may have rituals accompany holidays. July 4th, Labor Day weekend, Memorial weekend, Thanksgiving. Ah, how is Thanksgiving observed and celebrated? Christmas. And with whom?
Yeah,
and then Christmas, the ritual of all rituals. And so over here, Christmas presents are exchanged and opened Christmas morning. And over here, it's done Christmas evening. And over here, it's done with, you know, other family members. We go to grandma or grandpa's. And over here, it's, you know, well, whoever happens to be here today. And this is a kind of laid-back family, and then some. So what happens in here? Or birthdays. When I would start working with a couple or meeting with a couple, a way of kind of getting acquainted, and instead of having circles and squares over here, I'd say, well, bring in some pictures of your family. This one gal brought in a whole stack of pictures, and you know, every single one of them was taken at somebody's birthday party, and in all of those pictures there were lots of people. Can you imagine, now this was her family, can you imagine what would happen if he forgets to get a birthday gift? I mean, you've gone from a big celebration that involves out-of-town relatives, family members, down to a Well, you know, is that going to be crushing or is it, yeah. So rituals having to do with how birthdays are celebrated, how anniversaries are celebrated, and all those other holidays. It's incredible. And people come into relationships expecting that those patterns will be continued. Oofta. Yeah. I was just thinking of an illustration and I lost it. Anybody have a question? I'll see if I can get it back. Go ahead.
Do you think that if the family, that one or the other is a stronger part of it, do you think that, for example, the mother is a stronger factor in keeping a family together? For example, if the mother should die at an early age or something like that, that the family might not be as close?
Yeah, well, those kinds of incidents very much upset the mobile, and some of them fall apart. So somebody came up to me last night and said, I thought you'd mentioned the oldest marrying the oldest. But your question reminds me of a family where the youngest married the youngest, and they had 7 children or 9. And then when the 2 oldest of the children left home, in this case, they both went to college, the whole place fell apart. You know who was in charge? Who were the responsible ones? Who were the key people that kept that family functioning? Well, the 2 oldest children. And when they left home, the rest of it just went Nobody was in charge. Everybody was just goofing off. So you bet when somebody dies or in whatever way leaves the household, has enormous consequences for that family system and structure. Violence. That was, there was a couple came in and this family over here handled disputes in a good Norwegian way. Mm-hmm. They just all went off to their own corner and pretended it didn't happen. When they sort of got over, then they came back together. And this system over here, when somebody was upset, everybody know about it, I mean right now, and there was no question about it, and you will. So Will and Kate got married. Oh, anybody see the cat?
Over here, anger doesn't let you suffer.
Logical consequences.
Right.
Okay, Kate and Will got married. Well, Will had really pretty well behaved himself during courtship times. In fact, the whole family, you know, whenever Kate was around, you know, everybody was acting kind of nicely. And so they'd been married for 2 weeks. And you know what happened? You know, Will just kind of blew corks out everywhere. And Kate, well, she didn't know what to make of it. And she went to see the pastor fully believing that they were going to get divorced. I mean, she, not that she wanted to be divorced, but she figured Will certainly wanted to be divorced, or was, yeah, I mean, you know, she had no way of assimilating, processing, and handling that kind of response. Because the family patterns dealing with whatever you want to call it, conflict, violence, however you want to categorize that incident, the patterns were so different. And they were each so unaware. I mean, you know, Will thought that they did things like that in Kate's family too. I remember Connie and I were married some 3 or 4 months. And she came home one day and found a six-pack of beer in the refrigerator. Mm. Now, you know, I grew up Lutheran and in German tradition, and there's beer around. And she grew up Dutch Reformed. And alcohol will get you thrown out of the church. And she opened the refrigerator door and, you know, the chin about hit the floor. Yeah. So, very different expectation. I didn't think anything of it. And she didn't think. She thought quite different. Okay, questions or comments or, right.
Okay, so as a single Christian girl, what kind of a family am I supposed to look for? Am I supposed to look for one opposite of mine or the same as mine? How do you suggest? Or do you?
Yeah. Well, I think by looking at this sort of thing, it raises some caution about marrying a person whose family system is so very different. Let's say culturally different from another country, religiously different. Not because the religion is so bad, as the practices, the values, the expectations are so different, so unfamiliar, so at this point unpredictable.
But have much luck talking people out of these marriages when love's involved?
Well, I don't try to talk them out of a marriage. I never
have. Well, when love's involved.
You know, there's one couple that I could have talked.
Expectations, you know. Pardon? I think it deals a lot more with expectations. You don't have to be of similar families, but you have to maybe, you know, if you think there's someone you love, that you kind of find out a little bit of his family so you know what to expect once you do get married.
Yeah. Yeah. So you have to be aware at least. Yeah. We'll do a couple family reunions and get there early
and
watch.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that. I want to come back to your question, but I have really encouraged lots of people to read this book. You know, people that I talk with, something that I work with. And it was real fun. It was a gal up here last summer that I urged her to read this book, and she did. And when I saw her this spring, she told me about a family reunion that, you know, the whole family had gotten together for Mom and Dad's 40th wedding anniversary. And she said that reunion was an anniversary celebration was unlike any other that the family had had, because some of her siblings had read the book. And one girl who was single and had great difficulty in her relationships with men was always very angry at her mother because her mother had had great difficulty in relationship with her husband. And so the initial opening was, why the hell didn't you ever divorce that? And then I'll just expletive delete it. And so then there was some conversation about that, in the midst of which in walked Dad, husband, and the conversation continued, and it continued for quite some time. And, you know, I'm not wanting to suggest, well, there was a magic cure. But what I hope for did happen, and that's that instead of these rules and behavior patterns being there and we all comply with it and have no control or influence on it, it got out on the table. And people did start to talk about it, which means they started to learn more about the other person, because it wasn't just learning about the other from the outside observable part, but from the inside they could hear and listen. And so a lot of baggage and pain that had been just sitting there, oh no, it's not just sitting there, it's festering inside like a cancer. You know, all that garbage came out and got dealt with, and some of it they could let go of. You know, which really leads into tomorrow's topic about talking about this stuff and how to talk about it. So instead of being enmeshed in this system and having to be a carbon copy about it, or instead of rejecting it and doing exactly the opposite, which means that system is still in charge, is still definitional for who I am and what I expect people to be, with this kind of a process, we can look at it a piece at a time, and we can say, this is my family, this is how we've functioned, and I can see it, but no thank you. I really choose to set that down and to do something differently and work at it. I don't mean it comes that easily, but that's the process. Or I can say, when I hear something about my family and how we've been functioning, and I treasure that. I agree with it, I embrace it, I claim it, and that's part of who I am, thank you. And hold on to it, knowing that I'm choosing to hold on to it, rather than it's got a hold of me and it's moving me around the way it or the family wants me to be moved around. That's the value of the process. And to enter into a relationship with somebody about whom I feel very strongly about whom I care and with whom I want to make a commitment, and to do that sort of thing jointly and say, yes, and now, you know, I see you for who you are and I for who I am, and we embrace each other. Which is a whole lot different than, well, I know you've got this habit, but I'm going to marry you and you're going to change because I'm going to change you. Now that's not embracing and caring. To say I'm going to change you, it's already saying we got problems. And to think that time, willy-nilly, you know, it's going to happen by itself, but it doesn't. The last thing that I want to say today, yesterday and today, has a hopeful air to it, but it's maybe presented a little bit more the pathology. It's kind of highlighted the problem areas. And again, tomorrow is supposed to be the cure and the answer for it all. But there's something else that I want to come back to your comment yesterday, your question. Come back to it and say, well, you know, this whole business, it's just some of the tools in my toolbox. And there's other material, there are other tools in the toolbox. And I don't think that we in the Christian tradition are limited to just the psychologist's tools. And using the psychologist's tools, we don't have to buy in, to the extent that we do, we don't have to buy into their value system about who a person is and what identifies a person. At that point, I can say that for each of us, somebody said it last night, what's one aspect about our identity? One person said, well, I'm a child of God. As children of God, we can say, well, we also have another parent who has adopted us into the family. And so, if I'm Will down here, and there's all this chaos in this family, there's another family which models other ways of caring and compassion and responsibility, and a whole long list. There's another family that I'm part of. There's another family who nurtures me and my identity and my values and my behavior. And I think that family needs to be taken equally seriously.